He knew of a cave. This is where he thought Carl lived. The cave was hidden behind a stand of pine and a great pile of stones, and my father knew of it from having rescued a young girl who had wandered into its depths many years ago. He stood before the cave and shouted, "Carl!" He heard his voice come back to him in an echo. "Show yourself. I know you're in there. I've come with a message from our town." Moments passed in the silence of the deep woods before my father heard a rustling, and a tremor seemed to move the earth itself. Then, from the darkness of the cave, rose Carl. He was bigger even than my father had dared to dream. And, oh, but his was a grisly visage, covered in cuts and bruises from living in the wild, and being so hungry at times that he didn't wait for his food to die, and sometimes his food fought back. His black hair was long and full of grease, his thick and tangled beard full of food, as well as the soft and spineless crawly bugs that dined there on his crumbs. When he saw my father, he began to laugh.
"What is it you want, little person?" he said with a terrible grin.
"You must stop coming into Ashland for your food," my father said. "Our farmers are losing their crops, and the children miss their dogs."
"What? And you intend to stop me?"
he said, his voice booming through the valleys, no doubt all the way back to Ashland itself.
"Why, I could snap you in my hands like a branch off a tree."
And to demonstrate, he grabbed the branch of a nearby pine and ground it to dust in his fingers.
"Why," he went on, "I could eat you and be done with you in a moment, I could."
"And that is why I've come," my father said. Carl's face twitched then, either from confusion or from one of the bugs that had crawled from his beard and up his cheek.
"What do you mean, that's why you've come?"
"For you to eat me," he said. "I am the first sacrifice."
"The first sacrifice?"
"To you, O great Carl, we submit to your power. In order to save the many, we realize we must sacrifice a few. That makes me, what, lunch?" Carl seemed confounded by my father's words. He shook his head to clear it, and a dozen creeping bugs flew from his beard and fell to the ground. His body began to shake, and for a moment he appeared about to fall and had to right himself by leaning against the mountain wall. It was as if he had been struck by a weapon of some kind. It was as if he had been wounded in battle.
"I," he said quite softly, even sadly, "I don't want to eat you."
"You don't?" my father said, greatly relieved.
"No," Carl said. "I don't want to eat anybody."
And a giant tear rolled down his beaten face.
"I just get so hungry," he said. "My mother used to cook the most wonderful meals, but then she left and I didn't know what to do. The dogs. I'm sorry about the dogs. I'm sorry about everything."
"I understand," my father said.
"I don't know what to do now," Carl said. "Look at me. I'm huge. I have to eat to live, but I'm all on my own now, and I don't know how to..."
"Cook," my father said. "Grow food, tend animals?"
"Exactly," Carl said. "I suppose I should just wander into the back of this cave and never come out. I've caused you too much trouble."
"We could teach you," my father said. It took Carl a moment to understand my father's words.
"Teach me what?"
"To cook, grow food. There are acres and acres of fields here."
"You mean I could become a farmer?"
Yes, my father said, you could. And this is exactly what happened. Carl became the biggest farmer in Ashland, but my father's legend became even bigger. It was said he could charm anyone just by walking through a room. It was said he was blessed with a special power, but my father was humble, and he said it wasn't that at all. He just liked people, and people liked him. It was that simple, he said. In which he goes fishing. Then came the flood, but what can I add to what has already been written? Rain, waves of rain, unceasing. Streams became rivers, rivers lakes, and all the lakes growing beyond their banks became one. Somehow, Ashland, most of it, was spared. The felicitous congruence of a mountain range, some say, parting the waters around the town. True, one corner of Ashland, houses and all, are still at the bottom of what is now called, appropriately if not very imaginatively, Big Lake. And the ghosts of those who died in the flood can still be heard on a summer night. But what's most remarkable about the lake is the catfish. Catfish as big as a man, they say, some bigger. Take your leg off if you swim too deep, leg and more sometimes if you don't watch out. Only a fool or a hero would try to catch a fish that size, and my father, well, I guess he was a little of both. He went by himself one morning at dawn and took a boat out toward the middle, deepest part of Big Lake. For bait, a mouse, deceased, found in the corn crib. He hooked it up and let her fly. It took a good 5 minutes to hit bottom, then he brought her up, slow. Soon, he got a strike. The strike took the mouse, the hook, everything. So he tried again. A bigger hook this time, stronger line, more sumptuous-looking dead mouse, and cast. The water was beginning to roil about now, roil and bubble and wave, as if the spirit of the lake was rising. Edward just kept fishing, just fishing. Maybe that was a bad idea, though, seeing how things were getting very unlake-like now, and scary. Maybe he'd reel in his little mouse and row on home. Okay, then. Only, as he reels, he notices the line's not moving so much as he is. Forward. And the faster he reels, the faster he moves. What he should do, he knows, is simple. Let go of the pole. Let it go. Throw it in and kiss it goodbye. Who knows what's on the other end of that line pulling him? But he can't throw it in, can't do it. His hands, in fact, feel like they're a part of the pole itself. So he does the second best thing and stops reeling. But the second best thing doesn't work either. He keeps moving forward, Edward does, and fast, faster than before. This is no log, then, is it? He's being pulled by a thing, a living thing, a catfish. Dolphin-like, he watches as it arcs out of the water, catching a ray from the sun as it does. Beautiful, monstrous, scary, 6, 7 feet long, and taking Edward with it now as it submerges, popping him right out of his boat and pulling him under and down, deep into the watery graveyard of Big Lake itself. And there, he sees the homes and the farms, the fields and the roads, that small corner of Ashland that was covered over in the flood. And he sees the people, too. There's Homer Kittredge and his wife Marla. There's Vern Talbot and Carol Smith. Homer's taking a bucket full of feed to his horses, and Carol's talking to Marla about corn. Vern's working on the tractor. Beneath fathoms and fathoms of shadowy green water, they move as if in slow motion. And when they talk, little bubbles leave their lips and rise to the surface. As the catfish carries Edward swiftly by, Homer smiles and begins to wave. Edward knew Homer, but can't quite finish the gesture before they're gone again. Fish and man, up and suddenly out of the water, where Edward is thrown, poleless now, to shore. He never told anybody about this. He couldn't. because who'd believe him? Questioned about loss of pole and boat, Edward said he fell asleep, dreaming on the banks of Big Lake, and they just drifted away. The day he left Ashland. And so it was, in roughly just this way, that Edward Bloom became a man. He was healthy and strong and loved by his parents. He was also a high school graduate. In the verdant fields of Ashland, he ran with his companions, and with gusto he ate and drank. It was life spent as if in a dream. Only one morning, he woke and knew in his heart that he must go. And he told his mother and father, and they didn't try to stop him. But they looked at each other with foreboding, because they knew there was but one road out of Ashland, and to leave by it meant passing through the place that had no name. Those who were meant to leave Ashland passed through this place unharmed, but those who weren't stayed there forever, unable to go forward or move back. And so they said goodbye to their son, knowing they might never see him again, and he the same. The morning of the day he left was a bright one, but as he made his way toward the place that had no name, the day grew dark, and the skies lowered, and a thick fog embraced him. Soon he arrived at a place much like Ashland itself, though different in important ways. On Main Street there was a bank, Cole's Pharmacy, the Christian Bookstore, Talbot's Five and Dime, Prickett's Place, Fine Jewels and Watches, the Good Food Cafe, a pool hall, a movie theater, an empty lot, a hardware store, and a grocery store, too, shelves stocked with items predating his birth. Some of the same stores were on Main Street in Ashland, but here they were empty and dark, and the windows were cracked, and the owners stared dully from the empty doorways. But they smiled when they saw my father. They smiled and waved. A customer, they thought. There was also a whorehouse on Main Street, right at the end there. But it wasn't like a whorehouse in the city. It was just a house where a whore lived. As he wandered into town, the people there ran to meet him, and they stared at his handsome hands. Leaving? They asked him. Leaving Ashland? They were a strange lot. One man had a shrunken arm. His right hand hung from his elbow, and the arm above the elbow was withered. His hand just peeked out of his sleeve, like a cat's head peeking out of a paper bag. One summer years ago, he had been riding in a car with his arm stretched out the window, feeling the wind. But the car was running too close to the side of the road, and instead of the wind, he felt the sudden sting of a telephone pole. Every bone in his lower arm was broken. His hand hung there now, useless, getting smaller and smaller with time. He welcomed my father with a smile. Then there was a woman, in her mid-50s about, who in almost every respect was perfectly normal. But this was the way with these people. In so many respects they were normal, there was just that one thing, that one terrible thing. Several years ago, she'd come home from work to find her husband hanging from a water pipe in the basement, suffered a stroke seeing him there, and as a consequence, the left side of her face had been forever frozen. Her lips sloped downward in the exaggerated form of a frown, the flesh around her eye sagging. She couldn't move that side of her face at all, and so when she spoke, only one side of her mouth opened, and her voice sounded trapped deep inside her throat. Words climbed her throat painfully in order to escape. She had tried to leave Ashland after these things happened, but this was as far as she got. And there were still others simply born the way they were, whose births had been the first and worst accidents. There was a hydrocephalic named Bert. He worked as a sweeper. Everywhere he went, he carried a broom. He was the whore's son and a problem to the men of this place. Most of them had been to see the whore, and any one of them could have been the boy's father. As far as she was concerned, they all were. She had never wanted to be a whore. The town had needed one. She had been forced into the position, and over the years, she became bitter, especially after the birth of her son. She began to hate her customers. It was a great joy, but a greater burden. He had no memory to speak of. He would often ask her, "Where's my daddy?" And she would aimlessly point out the window at the first man she saw. "There's your daddy," she'd tell him. He'd run outside and throw his arms around the man's neck. The next day, he'd remember nothing about it, though, and he'd ask her, "Where's my daddy?" And he'd get another one, just like that. Finally, my father met a man named Willie. He'd been sitting on a bench and stood when Edward walked up, as if he'd been waiting for him. The edges of his lips were dried and cracked. His hair was gray and bristly, and his eyes were small and black. He'd lost three of his fingers, two on one hand, one on the other. And he was old. He was so old that he seemed to have gone as far forward in time as a human possibly could, and, as he was still alive, had started the trip backward. He was shrinking. He was becoming small, like a baby. He moved slowly, as though he were walking knee-deep through water, and he looked at my father with a grim smile.
"Welcome to our town," he said to him in a friendly, if somewhat tired way. "Mind if I show you around?"
"I can't stay," my father said. "I'm just passing through."
"That's what they all say," Willie said as he took my father by the arm, and together they began to walk. "Anyway," he continued, "what's your hurry? You should at least have a look at all we have to offer. Here we have a store, a nice little store. And here, over here," he said, "we have a place to go if you want to shoot the pool. Billiards, you know. You might like that."
"Thank you," Edward said, because he didn't want to anger this Willie or any of the others who were watching them. Already they had attracted a small crowd of three or four people who were following them through the otherwise empty streets, keeping their distance, but leering in a wanting kind of way. "Thank you very much." Willie's grip grew stronger still as he showed him the pharmacy, then the Christian bookstore, and then, winking slyly, the house where the whore lived.
"She's sweet, too," Willie said,
and then, as if remembering something he hadn't meant to, said,
"Sometimes."
The sky was darker now, and a light rain began to fall. Willie looked up and let the water fall into his eyes. My father wiped his face and grimaced.
"We have our share of rain," Willie said, "but you get used to it."
"Everything here seems sort of damp," my father said. Willie cut him a glance.
"You get used to it," he said. "That's what this place is all about, Edward, getting used to things."
"It's not what I want," he said.
"That too," he said. "You get used to that too."
They walked on in silence through the fog that gathered around their feet, through the rain that fell softly on their heads and shoulders, through the dusk-like morning of this strange town. People gathered on the corners to watch them pass, some of them joining the contingent that followed. Edward caught the gaze of a gaunt man in a ragged black suit and recognized him. It was Norther Winslow, the poet. He had left Ashland just a few years ago to go to Paris to write. He stood looking at Edward and almost smiled. But then Edward caught sight of his right hand, which was missing two of its fingers, and Norther's face turned pallid, and clutching his hand to his chest, he disappeared around a corner. People had put a lot of hope in Norther.
"Sure," Willie said,
seeing what had just happened.
"People like you come through here all the time."
"What do you mean?" my father said.
"Normal people,"
Willie said, which seemed to leave a bad taste. He spit.
"Normal people and their plans. This rain, this dampness, it's a kind of residue. The residue of a dream. Of a lot of dreams, actually. Mine and his and yours.
Not mine, Edward said.